And welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction in the ancient world. This season has been all about reception of the ancient world in pop culture, so now it's time to hear what the team have to say about the Golden Age on the silver screen. Yesterday, they're going to be persuading me to watch their favourite examples of reception in movies, and I can't wait to add them to my watch list. Flicking through PrimeFlix Plus is such a chore, and by the time I've picked something, my spaghetti's inevitably gone cold and I realise I already watched this last year, so I hope the team provide me with some absolute bangers today. On the team we have Xenia, who always rolls out the red carpet for the ancient Romans. We've also got Meg, who loves ancient Greek blockbusters as much as she loves busting blocks when it comes to knowledge about them. And of course we have Barney, who is our premier source for info on the ancient Near East. I'm Flo. And although I don't know much about the ancient world, I love me a good film. So as soon as I've found out where my toddler's hidden the remote, I'll be ready to learn about the ancient world in movies with you today, dear listener. Do you smell that? Yes, that's popcorn that's burnt and clinging to the bottom of the pot. I'm so excited because today's episode, you guys are going to be pitching to me your movie suggestions. Now, I'm very excited about this because it's very shame to say that my father's a bookseller and I've got hundreds of books and they all look at me longingly and reminding me of a time where I had the time to read the books. But I tell you what I do have time for, and that is sitting on my bum and watching the telly. So I'm really excited about today's pictures. I'm going to pick on one of you at random to bring me something to watch today. And I think I'm going to go with you, Xenia. I'm going to start with you. What have you brought to me today to pitch that I should watch?
Dun, 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 dun.
Okay, that's not Jurassic Park. Oh, it's Gladiator. Okay.
Yeah. Could it be any... Sorry, I am a bit tone deaf, actually, so maybe that wasn't my finest hour on the podcast. Oh my gosh, I love it. It's, of course, I am bringing you Gladiator, the 2000 epic. It's such a phenomenal film. And what I love about it the most, it's not obviously totally historically accurate because it's set within the Roman world and it's set with a real Roman emperor and everything and real Roman battles, but it's not meant to be reflective of real Roman events. It's like a made up story set within that context. But I think what it does so beautifully is just captures the kind of the psychology and the philosophy and the essence of Rome, like what Rome is as a concept, as an idea, as something that stretches far beyond the individual. That's what it really gets for me. And yet it also has some of the tragedy in there, that personal tragedy, that and the viciousness of emperors and the abuse of power. Oh, I love it. And it has a great soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
I just want to be clear, Xenia, this is Gladiator and not Gladiators, the 90s game show with Ulrika Johnson in it, right?
Correct.
Okay, so tell me a bit more. I want a little bit of a flavour about Gladiator. Why should I watch it? So it captures exactly this, the Roman Empire's attitude. Tell me a little bit more about that because I'm still not sold. You need to tell me more.
Okay, so I'll do a little bit of a plot summary. Gladiator follows a Roman general called... Maximus, played by Russell Crowe, and he's serving under Marcus Aurelius, and he's very, very loyal to Marcus Aurelius at this point. Marcus Aurelius is quite an old man, and they're on campaign in Germany. They're fighting German tribes, and Marcus Aurelius's children come along to visit him. Now, Marcus Aurelius actually had a lot of children, but his eldest son was called Commodus, and in Roman history, this guy was a bit of a bully. He was quite sort of brutish, I suppose. He fancied himself as a gladiator, actually. But in the film, he's played by Joaquin Phoenix, and he's like quite he's plotting. He's ambitious. He's quite sadistic. People don't trust him. People don't believe in him as much as they do his father. And the other person who comes along is Marcus Aurelius's daughter, called Lucilla. And she, in times gone by, had a relationship with Maximus, which Commodus is really jealous of. This sort of comes into the plot a bit later as well. Anyway, they're fighting. Scene is set. They're fighting. Maximus wins the battle. Marcus Aurelius goes to Commodus and says, I'm not going to name you emperor. I'm actually going to give Rome back to the people. I'm going to make it a republic again. But Commodus has been building up his whole life to be emperor. And so he actually suffocates his father in this really amazing, like, dramatic scene. So Marcus Aurelius is dead. Commodus is like, oh no, Maximus, come and pay respects. Your emperor is dead. And Maximus immediately clocks what's happening and realizes that, because he was Marcus Aurelius's favorite, realizes that he's now in the firing line. So he tries to escape, but then he gets chased down and he's badly injured, but he manages to fight off all of the people that Commodus has tried to send to kill him. And he's traveling, he's trying to get from Germany back to his hometown in Spain. But when he gets there, he finds that Commodus's men have got there already and they've murdered his wife and his son. It's really very sad. So he kind of has nothing left to live for, and he's sort of collapsed at the foot of his farm under the bodies of his wife and child. And then he gets picked up by a kind of traveling merchant and becomes enslaved and is trained as a gladiator because, you know, he was a soldier, he's a top commander, he's basically very fit. And so they train him as a gladiator, and he's this excellent gladiator. And then he goes to Rome for these great celebratory games that Commodus is putting on to celebrate the fact that he's emperor. And he starts kind of having this personal challenge with Commodus, reveals who he is in this epic speech. He goes, my name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next.
I know exactly this scene you're talking about, and it's longer than that. It's like, it's something like, my name is Maximus Daenerys Targaryen, husband to a murdered wife, father to a murdered son, queen of dragons, the Unburn, etc. And I think I know an against the law about this film. I think I actually have something to bring to the table. So I don't know what rancid, like, BuzzFeed article I pulled this from out of my brain, but I swear that there's an against the law where Jacqueline Phoenix gives a thumbs down to say, I want him killed. And that's actually not something that would have happened, right?
Absolutely. Yes, this is, oh, well done. This is like my favourite against the law about sort of Roman gladiator competitions. So first of all, most of the time they didn't actually kill a gladiator at the end. The loser didn't have to die. And second of all, actually thumbs down was live.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they got it real backwards.
Yeah, that's about the whole thing with classical reception, right? Because we have our modern ideas of how things are done. And sometimes in order to be totally historically accurate, that would really confuse modern audiences because our perceptions of what things mean have changed so much.
Thumbs down means bad. It means, oh, get rid of him. He's done a bad job.
Exactly. So it's all about the hand placement on the sword. So if you're gripping the sword with your fist to like stab down and kill the gladiator, your thumbs are up, aren't they?
Oh, dang. Oh, okay. That makes loads of sense. And if you have your thumbs up, you're holding your sword up like, nah, all right, he gets a pass this time, he's going to live because I'm holding my sword up in the air.
Totally. So that's where they had to change it a bit to sort of make it make sense to modern sensibilities. And there are a few different things like that people do sometimes get annoyed about in terms of historical accuracy and stuff. But I do think, you know, you have to be conscious of your audience, right? This film was made in 2000 for a modern audience who wanted, you know, a big sort of battle-y epic with Russell Crowe in it, let's be honest. That's what you have to sort of do a bit of give and take, and that's why I really want to focus on this kind of essence of Rome that they captured rather than the nitty-gritty of did they get the thumbs up, thumbs down right.
I think that's so true, Xenia, and also I feel like with classical reception it all just comes down to what the purpose of it is. And I think it's a pet peeve of mine when people get so sort of like, and they do it with all time periods, it's not just the ancient world, but like, oh well, actually, you know, the dress cut wouldn't have been like that in Pride and Prejudice. And you're like, I don't care. I literally don't care. I'm watching it because I like it and not because I want to learn exactly, you know, the historical accuracy. So I think just completely agree.
I agree with you, Meg. I can't watch anything that has any kind of historical battles in it with my husband, because he goes, well, firstly, that's a Lee Enfield. I don't know why they think it would be in that battle. That's stupid. Or that uniform's all wrong. Or they've got horses. Okay. It becomes literally unwatchable. I can't handle it.
Yeah, there's such a thing as too much fact. And you don't normally hear me say that.
Yeah. We don't need to well actually everything, do we?
There was a couple of things I wanted to weigh in on for Gladiator, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Of course.
One was obviously Xenia's incredible musical intro there, which we all recognised as one of the main themes from Gladiator. But if Xenia had come in singing, you might have thought she'd gone mad, because that's obviously the Pirates of the Caribbean theme tune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously.
But if you go back and watch that first battle in Germany at the start of the movie, you can hear that Hans Zimmer, I think it's Hans Zimmer.
It is. This is one of his like debut scores.
That Hans Zimmer was playing with motifs at this point. Gladiator predates Pirates of the Caribbean, that then recur in his theme for Pirates of the Caribbean. So really, like when the catapults are shooting their flaming balls or whatever, it's going bun dun 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 dun.
No way. Honestly, that's so good.
Honestly,
that's some reception
if you
right
listen
there.
To it. Exactly. I'll try and find a clip on YouTube that we can maybe link to, because it's quite uncanny.
I'd fall for the subliminal messaging whilst watching it and going, do you know what, actually, instead of Gladiator, should we watch Pirates of the Caribbean? I don't know why, just in the mood for it.
Something is just really getting me in the mood for Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm always in the mood, actually.
Yeah, same.
And then the other thing is that obviously it's a timely time to be talking about Gladiator, because Gladiator 2 is or was scheduled to come out in 2024. I think the strikes may have delayed it a little bit, but there's going to be a sequel with everybody's hottest favourite two actors, Paul Mescal and Barry Keoghan.
Oh, sweet. I thought you were going to say Timothée Chalamet then, but after Wonka, I'm not so sure he's everyone's favourite.
No, obviously that's Matthew Bainton.
Oh, God, they should put Matthew Bainton in it.
I was just thinking, like, imagine Matthew Bainton going, I am Maximus Decimus Meridius. No.
there's a sketch in The Horrible Histories where, why have you named it Alexandria after yourself? Well, because if we named it after you, it would be called Skinny Mandria. So I want to see Matthew Bainton as Skinny Mandria in Gladiator 2. That would be amazing. Anyway, sorry.
I mean, fanficking Gladiator 2 is not also entirely outside the realms of reality, since before the current Gladiator 2 script existed and had been filmed, there was one written by famous musician Nick Cave. Have you guys heard about this?
As in, and the bad seeds, Nick Cave.
I love Nick Cave, though.
Really?
So yeah. Nick Cave wrote a script for Gladiator 2 in which Maximus awakens in the underworld. And essentially completes a series of quests there before coming back to life in Rome and trying to find his dead son, who is no longer dead. Neither is he, because he's come back to life. And it turns out the nephew from the original film, the other potential like heir to the throne, has become an emperor worse than Commodus was, and Maximus has to take him down. And then in the end, Maximus ends up being immortal and fights through the ages in various different famous battles like the Crusades and Vietnam.
Oh my God. Shotgun this for my favourite thing.
It is depressing, though, when you know where the inspiration might have come from. Nick has lost two of his sons. So a concept of a fan fiction of a world where he might be able to be reunited with his son is really sad. And I just thought I'd make everyone feel really depressed with that knowledge. So you're welcome, I guess.
Apparently Russell Crowe just said, no, I don't like it, mate.
Oh, yeah. No. No. Not a fan. I'm going to have to watch Gladiator then. I do have some experience watching Gladiators, the 90s game show, but I might have to watch Gladiator. That does sound really good. But I'm holding out until I hear the last two pitches of today's episode. Barney, I'm going to pick on you next. Can you tell me what film you've brought to pitch to me?
Hello. I have come today with a pitch and an anti-pitch. And the game
is for you to work out which is which. Which pitch is which? Okay, so on the one hand, we have... I'll start with the older film first. So on the one hand, we have a DreamWorks animation from 1998 called The Prince of Egypt, which is, as the title might suggest, set in Egypt. And that's because it's an adaptation of the Book of Exodus and features the story of Moses leaving the captivity in Egypt and making his way to the Promised Land.
Barney, this better be the pitch. It better be the pitch and not the anti-pitch, because this film slaps. And if it's the anti-pitch, I'm going to be so angry. Sorry, Barney, carry on.
No, it's okay. It's okay. At the moment, I'm just neutrally describing the plots of the two films, so I won't give the game away.
Okay.
So that's probably enough for The Prince of Egypt, actually. The second one is another of Egypt film, and it's a 2016 action movie called Gods of Egypt, which adapts elements from ancient Egyptian mythology and features the gods of ancient Egypt, like Horus and Set, being able to turn into big, shiny, transformer-like bird creatures and do battle with each other, like Harrier jump jets in the air.
That sounds very reasonable and normal.
Yep. And very realistic and accurate and very much in line with the source material.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that your anti-pitch might be the Harrier jump jet Egyptian gods. Potentially.
Yeah,
okay, good.
Now, it's not to say that I didn't enjoy The Gods of Egypt. Gods of Egypt came out, as I said, I think in 2016, which was just when I was finishing my degree in ancient Near Eastern studies. And so as a treat to myself, after a long time studying for finals, I went to go and see The Gods of Egypt in the cinema. And, you know, it's a pretty stupid film. The sun god Ra does have his big solar barge, but it's sort of more like a spaceship in the sky. And one of the sort of the magical MacGuffins that is so popular in these kind of action movies is the Eye of Horus, which everybody can probably picture as that very famous line drawing of an eye with sort of makeup around it from ancient Egypt, which people use as a good luck charm. In The Gods of Egypt, it's literally Horus's eye, and it has to be plucked out of his head, and it like empowers the bad guy, Set. So if you actually look at the poster of the film, the Eye of Horus is a blue eye on the cover of the poster, and that's really how stupid it is. It's somebody's eyeball. And I think the fact that it's blue is of some interest as well, because because of how casting worked in this film, because despite the fact that it's supposed to take place in ancient Egypt, the two main characters are... Well, the three main characters, I suppose, but the two main characters playing gods are Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who is Danish, I think, and Gerard Butler, who is Scottish. So they didn't get anywhere near the Mediterranean with this casting.
Is Nikolai Coster-Waldau, is he the guy who plays Jaime in Game of Thrones?
Yes, yeah. He's Jaime Lannister.
But Gerard Butler's got form for covering characters that we've discussed before, because I actually did go away after the episode about Percy Jackson, and he is one of the characters in that. He's one of the gods in that film, I seem to remember. So he's got form.
We may be straying into Meg's territory here, but he's also in 300.
Ooh.
Mm. Wow. Typecast.
Ooh. Whispers of things to come. Okay, Barney, well, I was so worried that you were going to say Prince of Egypt was going to be your anti-pitch. I was really worried about that, because I think it's really good. It's a really good film.
No, I don't have any reason to slate The Prince of Egypt. It's a very fond memory of my childhood. I really enjoyed it when I was little. And obviously, it's really is more adapting biblical sources than it is anything ancient Egyptian. Although they do take a stand on which Pharaoh is the Pharaoh of Exodus, which is not something that has been settled on historically. So in the film, it's Ramesses the Great who is supposed to be the Pharaoh of Exodus, which kind of makes sense. Famous name, recognizable to audiences, and obviously one of the biggest name pharaohs. But yeah, I think Egyptologists, historians, and some Bible scholars won't have landed on a definite Pharaoh of Exodus. In the real history. But yes, I like Prince of Egypt. It's got a very sort of traumatic representation of the, or traumatizing representation of the 10 plagues. Some of the animation is just absolutely beautiful, you know, fire raining down in front of the massive head of the Sphinx, for example. It's a pretty beautiful film, and, you know, part of this sort of late blooming golden age of animation in the 1990s that was basically superseded by computer generated animation, which leads me to one of my favorite facts about the Prince of Egypt, if you'd like to hear it.
Immediately.
Cool. Please. So what I like about the Prince of Egypt is that DreamWorks were making it at the same time as they were making another 90s animated classic, which was Shrek. And DreamWorks was hoping...
And they used the Pirates of the Caribbean music as well.
DreamWorks was hoping that the Prince of Egypt would be their big landmark animation, and I think they thought that Shrek was their sort of second tier movie. And so if people were really shoved towards Prince of Egypt to work on that, but if they couldn't, or if they were underperforming, misbehaving, whatever, they'd get sent downstairs to work on Shrek. And obviously Shrek became the higher grossing film in the box office, and like massive cultural success, right? Like huge meme appeal, still remembered to this day, massive franchise. Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah, at the time DreamWorks backed Prince of Egypt more, and people voted with their ticket stubs.
I love the idea that there's like a hierarchy, and it's like you get sent down to Shrek, and it's like, do you want to animate, you know, God or Shrek?
ogre farting in a swamp.
An ogre. Amazing.
But yeah, no, I like Prince of Egypt, and whilst I'm not a Bible expert, and it doesn't really represent any chapters that are part of Egypt's own telling of its history, I still think it nails the setting quite well, and I recommend it on that basis.
Yeah, I love the scale of the Egyptian buildings, and that is just so, given kind of what else was around at the time, that huge scale is really kind of, it makes sense actually as like the relative scale. Where do you stand on the epic song about the Egyptian gods in that?
Yeah, this is the two sort of magician priest type figures, isn't it? Yeah, am I right in remembering the beginning of the song is just them whispering the names of ancient Egyptian gods?
Yeah.
I seem to remember like Imhotep comes up very badly at one point.
Shall I quickly look up the lyrics now?
Yeah,
is that the big boys one?
Yes,
you're playing with the big boys now. What a tune! It's got some great songs. It's got some really great songs. Also, just before we hear the next act, can I just say the scene where the pharaoh's son dies is like, that was one of my most traumatic, like you were saying, Barney, traumatic watches as a child. I found that so upsetting, and I think it's such a like heartbreaking. The animation there is so beautiful when he carries his body. Just wow.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's exactly what I was getting at. Like, some of the plagues are just, you know, a bit gross. Like the cattle, the livestock dying is unpleasant, and the frogs coming out of the Nile and the blood, you know, that's all quite vivid. But yeah, I think when we've got the death of the firstborn and this sort of ethereal mist kind of drifting into houses and all these women shrieking as they find their sons dead, it's not the kind of material you'd normally expect to see in a musical.
No, and it's not in Shrek, so... Much though I wish it was.
But yes, no, the beginning to Playing with the Big Boys is really just a list of so many Egyptian gods, and they're all legit gods. Sobek, Anubis, Nephthys, Ptah, Khnum, it's all the big names. Does it start with them saying, by the power of Ra?
Yeah.
Which we should maybe all start saying as an exclamation.
Welcome to the podcast, by the power of Ra. Okay, so we're all in agreement. Prince of Egypt slaps, Gods of Egypt maybe not so much, which I'm going to bear in mind as an anti-pitch. I think it's still valid as a pitch, Barney, so I'm still including it. It does sound intriguing, to be fair, this Transformers-esque Eye of Horus, powerful. What is it, the Tesseract in Transformers? That's the sort of homologue of this Eye of Horus. I still think that's quite interesting, but... Do you know what I haven't heard? I haven't heard Meg's pitch yet. I'm ready for Meg to pitch me something good.
Are you ready? I think you probably know what I'm going to pitch. It's actually not Hercules. I've already mentioned Hercules. Obviously an absolutely iconic film that I would love to watch any day of the week. But it's got to be Troy. 2004. I think it's 2004. And I did my PhD on Homer's Iliad and the reception of it. And I actually managed to not talk about Troy because I was meant to be talking about like poems written in English in the second half of the 20th century. And sort of, I think quite valiantly for me, to be honest, I did not go down any long tangents about the film Troy. But it is so good. It gets a bad rep. Its reputation precedes it, I think, in many ways. And it is ridiculous. It's a fully ridiculous film. Brad Pitt as Achilles is a revelation, and I don't know whether I mean that in a good way or a bad way. I can't really, you know, process it, but it's got such a good cast. I think that is something genuinely, so many big names. It's got like Orlando Bloom in it. Brian Cox is Agamemnon. Most recently, we all probably saw him in Succession, but you know, doing a bit of Agamemnon, arguably also a Succession myth that goes a bit wrong for several members of that family. Anyway, I've wrote down wrote down the things I liked and the things I didn't like. I'll just rattle through them. Good is obviously the whole cast. Sean Bean, fantastic. Paris, Orlando Bloom as Paris is actually just perfect somehow. Love it. They get rid of gods, which I think is the right call, to be honest. I think one of the things we might talk about in our TV episode is the BBC Troy Fall of a City, which is obviously telling the same story, and the way that they approach the gods is very different. And I, to be honest, I just think Troy made the right call. It's so difficult to represent them on screen, so they're just kind of not there. And this is a niche thing, but Briseis, who is a sort of slave girl, basically like an enslaved woman in the Greek camp in the Iliad, and is one of the people, I know I said in the first episode of this series, that I'm not sure women are silenced in sort of ancient literature to the extent that modern literature would have us believe. Briseis definitely is silenced. She does not get a voice. She's enslaved. She is literally sort of, you know, ordered around, passes between the leaders like cattle or whatever. It's really horrible. And she doesn't really get a good ending in the Iliad. But in Troy, she kills Agamemnon. Huge slay, literal slay. She stabs him. Fantastic. Love that.
Clytemnestra who?
Yeah, exactly. Literally. Just like that's, and it is again funny because the story of Agamemnon's descendants, that's the whole basis for the Oresteia, which is one of the absolute kind of classics of Greek tragedy. And Troy 2004 is just like, no. Briseis stabs him at the end of the Trojan War. Fantastic. Bad things. David Benioff is the screenwriter, and I really liked Game of Thrones and haven't quite forgiven him for what happened there. So just a little negative shout out.
Listen, we don't talk about the ending.
No, exactly. It would be mad to think that Troy does not impact Game of Thrones because it's got Sean Bean in it and David Benioff is the screenwriter. Yeah, another bad thing that I think is they do make Achilles and Patroclus cousins, which is just a little bit sort of, I just don't think the plot works if you try and claim that that's basically their relationship. They are in Homer distantly related. They're like first cousins once removed or something. But that's not going to stop them being much more than that in the ancient world. And I just think it's a bit of a cop out. It's a bit cowardly maybe, but you know, I can also kind of understand it. But I think they should have just made them full on lovers. That's my opinion.
How else could they love and care about each other deeply if they weren't cousins, Meg?
Well, Barney, when two ancient Greek men love each other very much, I think they should have just gone for it and had them be in love, because it's the whole plot turns on Achilles' love for Patroclus and his absolute devastation, the kind of utter like depths of his grief when he's dead. And I just don't think it really makes sense to be like, yeah, just his pal, his cousin, his buddy.
What do you think of the directing of it? I can't remember if it is, if it's Achilles himself or if it's when Patroclus is cosplaying as Achilles, but the assault on the beach basically being like ancient D-Day.
Yeah, I like that. I actually think something that it gets quite right is the sort of setting and the scale. And I think it's hard, you know, it's really hard to do. And that's been criticized. People think it looks sort of cheap, but I actually think it works well. And I do like that bit a lot. I like the sort of staging of it almost. And I basically think, my opinion is, you can't adapt the Iliad and expect into a film and expect it to be a faithful adaptation. So you might as well have some fun with it. You might as well have Orlando Bloom there. And yeah, 10 out of 10, great film.
Yeah, I fully agree on that. I love that opening and just the scale of all the ships. Obviously, they look digitally created because they are. But yeah, the kind of wooden stakes in the ground. I guess the only slightly annoying thing there is it's probably, I think it should be a little greener to be historically accurate. But again, we're not going for that in this episode really so much, are we?
But it's set in the east, so it has to be dry and dusty.
It's dry and dusty and orange.
Xenia.
Missed that memo.
It's the ancient Mexico.
What about the lost sequels? So there could have been a nice Odyssey sequel. There could have been an Aeneid sequel because Aeneas appears towards the end.
There could. I do love that cameo.
I think there is a Troy sequel. There is a Troy. He's a basketball champion, but he has to fight himself to try and do a theatre show, I think, with some girl he fancies in a high school drama. I've forgotten what it's called now, but I'm pretty sure there is a Troy sequel.
I mean, Achilles does have a difficult decision to make. And I think, you know, when I said you can't make a faithful adaptation of the Iliad into a film, maybe you can. And maybe that film is High School Musical.
It could be. I also want to draw everyone's attention to the fact that Sean Bean, as you mentioned, who was in Troy, was also one of the fathers in the Percy Jackson films. And he was brother, in fact, to Gerard Butler. So I'm just saying there's links everywhere. They're all being typecast.
Typecast, yep.
We're all connected. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's because they are actually gods. They just keep coming back. Sean Bean will never die.
Sean Bean.
Well, he dies ironically in every film he's in, Xenia. So I think really he just will never stay dead. Maybe that's it. Right. So I've had all of your pitches now. I'm going to save my decision on what I'm going to go and interact with until the end because I'm a coward. And I'm going to start, Barney, with you. What was the thing that was pitched that you want to go and watch?
I think it was interesting that Xenia and Meg both bought pitches that sometimes more anal scholars of ancient history do criticise for their ahistoricity. So that was quite refreshing to hear, like justifications from real ancient Rome and Greece nerds, TM, of these movies that people sometimes write off. And they are both films that I've seen many, many times over the years. But the one based on today's pitching that I think I'd most readily revisit is Troy.
Okay, well, that's what Meg brought to the table. Xenia, I'm going to go to you next. What was your favourite thing from today?
I would like to rewatch Prince of Egypt, I think. That is, I saw the musical recently. I don't think I've seen the animation in quite a while. So I think that would be a lovely thing to go back and watch.
I think it would be a good thing to watch. I think it's one of those things that looking back as an adult, you're like, wow, that's got some really dark stuff in it. But I definitely watched it as quite a young child.
Yeah, I'm realising actually that a lot of children's films have some quite sort of dark openings and premises. I guess they have to do that kind of the hero's conundrum, don't they? Mm. And that ends up sometimes being quite dark. But you also, like, this seems to be a theme coming out, right? Even in the last episode when we were talking about ancient novels, you know, often the way they start out is by some sort of horrible tragedy or lovers being separated or some sort of horrible abuse happening. So, yeah. Stories be dark, man.
I find it really funny that I found Prince of Egypt completely fine as a child, but I was traumatised by an episode of Pingu where a large walrus comes out of an ice hole. That's traumatised me for life. Meg, I'm going to come to you next. What was your favourite thing from today that you're going to go and watch?
I will just say I have actually never seen Gladiator, genuinely. So I think, to my shame, I need to go watch that.
No, really?
I know. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I don't know why. I've not been avoiding it. It just has never happened for me. So I'm definitely going to go and watch that based on not only your recommendation, but also your rendition of some key scenes and music, Xenia. I'm very excited.
Thank you. Try and watch the director's cut. That's got some really cool extra scenes in it where Commodus is even more evil. The music is just amazing. The ending makes me cry every single time without fail. Oh, it's so good.
You guys are going to hate my answer because I'm going to say that I really want to watch Gladiator as well because I've never seen it. I also want to watch Troy because I've never seen that. I'm going to watch Prince of Egypt because I love it. And if I'm feeling in a bit of a goofy, fun mood, I think I might watch Gods of Egypt as well. Listen, I am really pumped to watch all of these that you've brought to me today. All of your pitches were successful. To me, I think I'm very excited to interact with these things. And finally, I might be able to put a face to the quote about the I am Bilbo Baggins.
Maximus Decimus Meridius.
That's it. Yes, that's it. Father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife. I'm very excited to watch
Commander of the Armies of the North.
All right, Sonia, wind your neck in. Okay, so I'm really excited to get the popcorn on the go and watch all of these. Thank you ever so much. Whether you're going away to watch Troy, Gladiator, Prince of Egypt, or God help you, the gods of Egypt, I hope you enjoyed today's episode and you can catch us next time for Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.